Welcome back to the program. The shock of the current economic crisis continues to confuse the country. Historically, like all such confusion, it can give rise to fear and allow demagogues of both the left and the right to exploit those fears. Back in the early 1930s, we were in a similar situation. At the depths of the Great Depression, FDR came to office with a basket full of ideas to try and solve the problems facing the nation. Not unlike today, many of those ideas infuriated both the left and the right. Today, Wall Street bankers have become public enemy number one, and gun ownership is at an all-time high. In the 1930s, the results of similar actions were equally devastating. Today, who knows? We're going to go back and look at that time today with my guest, Sally Denton. She is the author of six previous books with the central theme of the exploration of subjects in American history that have been long neglected or marginalized. She's been an investigative reporter, a nonfiction author, and a historian. She's a Guggenheim Fellow, a Woodrow Wilson Public Scholar, and a Hoover Institute Media Fellow. It is my pleasure to welcome Sally Denton here to talk about The Plot Against the President, FDR, A Nation in Crisis, and the Rise of the American Right. Sally Denton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Wow, that's it makes me exhausted just to think about those things. Well, I mean, I'm really not 80 years old.
No. It's great to have you here. One of the things that is so remarkable looking back at the time that Roosevelt took office is what you referred to and what was referred to at the time are the Roosevelt haters. And the kind of rage against Roosevelt that is so similar in so many respects to what we're seeing today in economic situations that were also not dissimilar.
Well, it was shocking to me while writing it. I mean, there were so many times that I thought, you know, I could just close my eyes and change it from Roosevelt to Obama or, you know, 1933 to 2011. And the parallels are just stunning. And that's both good and bad. I mean, the good thing is that if America could survive what it went through in 1933, it can survive where we are today.
The other aspect of it is the attacks coming from both the left and the right, and even the inconsistency of them. On the one hand, Roosevelt being called a socialist. On the other hand, Roosevelt being called a fascist. It was no matter what he did, it was wrong as far as these extremes were concerned.
Yes, and again, you know, parallels to today and Obama. The country was really at play at that moment, and you know, the economic crisis was so deep and so unrelenting that it just seemed that maybe it was never going to end, and maybe there was a lot of exploration into different possibilities for forms of government, whether or not capitalism and democracy was even working. I mean, there was significant, serious flirtation with such systems as fascism, and you know, Roosevelt was. I mean, he just was playing every single. It was an experiment. Every single thing. So he was ramming stuff through Congress as fast as he could, and it created a lot of both excitement and fear.
And the fear was really a key element of it, as it is today. I mean, as Roosevelt so eloquently put it in terms of talking about the only thing we had to fear, this sense of fear that really provided the fuel for demagogues from both sides.
It did. And, you know, you saw the rise of Huey Long as from the left and Father Coughlin from the right, and then they would make, you know, they would kind of coalesce together. But the fear, I mean, it was really brilliant, I think, of Roosevelt, even before he really knew how he was going to approach everything in the first 100 days. I mean, he got started before, you know, while the inaugural balls were still going on. But I think he just realized that the most important thing was to get the American public coalesced in a desire to take action of some kind, any kind, just to get together.
The other aspect of it is that even though the attacks that were coming from the left and the right were all sort of directed towards Roosevelt as having some kind of grand design or evil plan or whatever it was, that in fact most of the New Deal and most of the legislation that Roosevelt was trying to get through at the time was improvisational. There was not really a plan. It was really just trying to throw everything at it and see what would stick.
Exactly. Not only was there no plan, but the irony of it was that Roosevelt single-handedly, you know, with a willing Congress, until they started, you know, getting concerned, basically he saved capitalism. And which, you know, the irony that he was considered a traitor to his class. I mean, he basically, you know, is the person who saved capitalism at a moment when the country was teetering. And the evil kind of, you know, the portrait of him as this evil person who had this grand design is just, it was just fabricated.
And of course, out of all of this hatred, out of this hostility, were two events that you focus on in the plot against the president, one coming from the left, one coming from the right.
Right. And both with, kind of Italian undercurrents, which was very strange for me. But initially I had planned, the book I started to write was about 1933, the entire year, and the beginning of the New Deal, the new presidency. But then as I was doing the research at the Hoover Institution, really initially into the right wing from my previous book, The Pink Lady, I came across this file of Raymond Mulvey, who was one of Roosevelt's advisors, where he talked about interviewing the assassin, Giuseppe Zangara, who attempted to assassinate FDR. And I read that file, and I was just fascinated by it. I mean, there were five people that were shot, and the mayor of Chicago died as a result. And I just thought, this is a really fascinating moment. It was in the interregnum, and, you know, very little known assassination attempt. I mean, very little had been written about it. And the other event was this alleged coup attempt, you know, where some Wall Street plotters were thinking about had conceived a plot to overthrow Roosevelt. And the Zangara, the assassin, was a anti-Mussolini, anti-fascist, anti-capitalist Italian immigrant who saw Roosevelt as kind of the uber-capitalist. And then the coup plotters were on the opposite extreme. They were really the right-wing kind of pro-fascist, saw Mussolini and what was going on in Italy as a beneficial prototype for the direction America should be going.
Why were these stories, and I want to take the assassination attempt first, did it get so little play, both relatively speaking at the time and particularly historically?
Well, I think, you know, I looked a lot at that. I think that initially, I think Roosevelt had played a role in that. I think that because America was so much on the verge of collapse, economic and culturally, socially, I mean, on a lot of different levels, I think that Roosevelt and the people around him determined to downplay the attention to it because it really was a pretty terrifying moment in where the country was. And then I think later, historians, it was, you know, there was an attempt to suggest that the intended target was Sir Anton Cermak, who was the mayor of Chicago, who at the time was, you know, coming down hard on Al Capone. So I think that the people around Roosevelt kind of encouraged this theorizing that it was maybe a mob hit and that Roosevelt was not the intended target. But it became very clear from the FBI documents and investigative files from Miami that they knew. I mean, Roosevelt knew that he was the target. They all knew that the president-elect was the target.
How active was Roosevelt in trying to tamp this down? You mentioned that he was actively involved in it. How active was he? How involved was he in trying to keep this story underplayed?
Well, I think that I think he just kind of downplayed it himself. And then, you know, when he returned to New York, he was surrounded by a phalanx of security. And he said, you know, he didn't want that to ever happen again. I mean, he didn't want the president to be surrounded by security. And in fact, when he was inaugurated, he refused to even have any kind of bulletproof device on the car. And but I think that it just kind of, I don't think it required any, like, cover-up or anything. I think it was just kind of, you know, it was just decided that we're not going to make a big deal out of this. And the press at the time kind of went along with it. And, I mean, it was a big deal in the newsreels and the theaters and stuff, but there was, and Zangara was executed immediately. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was, talk about a lack of constitutional defense here, but so the whole thing just kind of happened very quickly.
And the Wall Street coup, how far did that get, and who was behind it?
Well, the Wall Street coup got, there was a retired Marine general named Smedley Butler who was approached by a group of Wall Street brokers who said that they wanted him to lead a veterans army. He was the most popular general. He was the most popular military person at the time. And at the time, there were several hundred thousand unemployed veterans who had been trying to get their bonuses and from World War One. And he was an iconic leader of this kind of huge disaffected group. And the American Legion, and working with some powerful Wall Street leaders, basically concocted an idea that they would be able to come in and encourage Roosevelt to step down, basically, in a bloodless coup, and install a another general as a dictator.
How did they think they would pull that off?
Well, they had a lot of money, and they had sent some operatives to Europe to explore, you know, how Mussolini pulled it off in Italy and what Hitler was doing in Germany, and they seemed to, you know, I mean, it was a harebrained crackpot scheme on the one hand, but it had some serious people behind it and some serious money behind it. And basically, Butler blew the whistle, and, you know, I mean, he was appalled by the entire, you know, approach, and he basically first went to J. Edgar Hoover and then to Congress, and there were congressional hearings held in secret, and basically it got stopped before it could get very far, because they approached the wrong person, mm-hmm. Butler, to lead the veterans.
What did Roosevelt know about it, and when did he know it, and how did he respond?
Well, he knew about it apparently pretty early, and I think he responded kind of in the same way as with the assassination. He wanted to just kind of, you know, nip it in the bud. I mean, you know, stop it, but also keep it quiet.
Talk a little bit about what his concerns were, what Roosevelt's concerns were, if all of these stories started to get out, if all of these attempts to overthrow the administration or assassination attempts, what were his broader concerns in terms of the impact of all of the cumulative impact of all of this?
I think his main concern was in getting America back to work and getting the economy restarted. That as long as there was this kind of deep depression, economic depression, people wandering the country looking for work, unemployment at, you know, 16%, and, you know, this absolute destitution and poverty. I think he saw that as long as that was happening, that the entire country was could go in a very dangerous direction, mm-hmm. and that neither a coup or an assassination or anything else would be that far-fetched, considering, you know, the tumult and the absolute devastation that was happening. So I think he was just single-minded in, you know, stopping the greed on Wall Street and stopping the getting employment projects, the CCC, getting Americans back to work and earning money and creating a middle class.
How did he react emotionally and personally to the kind of Roosevelt hatred that was out there? I mean, it was pretty vitriolic, as we've alluded to. And what impact did it have on him personally?
My you know, based on my research and reading of the, you know, the Roosevelt scholars, I would say that he was very, you know, I mean, he welcomed them. He realized that he was going to bear the brunt of this kind of attack. It didn't deter him. If anything, I think it emboldened him and galvanized him to continue doing what he was doing. And I think that he was, I mean, he was not fearful. In fact, there were apparently, you know, he was famous for the calm during this assassination attempt and wouldn't even let the Secret Service or his, police escort get him away from the scene until he had, you know, Cermak in the car with him. And, I think he was just, you know, he thought that he was, I think that he thought that he was on a divine mission, which is, you know, controversial in itself right. At this point. But I think he was felt divinely inspired to, you know, take America through this dark storm.
Which of these events do you think has more historical significance?
Well, I think, I think probably the coup attempt. Mm-hmm. I think I went as far with it as could possibly, anyone could possibly go, given the shortage of documentation. And, you know, so many of the documents were sealed and that I mm-hmm. later found, but the investigation came to a halt. And I think Roosevelt was also influential in keeping the investigation from going too far. Because he just wanted it to end, and he didn't want, you know, this widespread fear in the country to continue.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, I mean, you're always going to have some wingnut assassins like Zangara.
Right.
But I think that the possibility of a coup, you know, that was potentially well armed veterans is a lot more potentially threatening to the democracy.
Why don't you tell us about Wall Street of the day?
Well, Wall Street was completely, unregulated. And, you know, there were no safety nets here. I mean, for as far as, you know, the federal, you know, people, their deposits were not insured. And there were, an extreme, a high amount of wealth in a tiny handful of brokers, and the banks were also investment firms and securities, and then there was the kind of gold standard I don't know what to say about the gold standard, because it was part of this conspiracy theory that Roosevelt was trying to take America off the gold standard, that Roosevelt was trying to, that he was secretly a Jew and he was trying to manifest this Jewish conspiracy, and that the Wall Street the white shoe Wall Street was like a very anti-Semitic climate, and, I think it was a pretty terrifying time.
Right, and that's another area where, this whole area you're talking about, where there are so many fascinating parallels to today in terms of the rise of all sorts of conspiracy theories and all of these stories that kind of get fed over time. And now, of course, with the Internet, they get even more fuel.
Right, yeah. I know, there's a... again, it's just, you know, a lot of the stuff is not even accurate. I mean, the stuff that is on the Internet about all of these conspiracy theories. And there's, you know, there can be kernels of truth in some of these things. But it's like the, you know, trying to prove that Obama is a Muslim or,
right.
you know, that he's not an American. I mean, that, there was a cottage industry doing the same thing against Roosevelt, trying to prove that he was Jewish, that he had Jewish blood from his Dutch ancestors, and that it was a Jewish conspiracy to take over America. And then it got into the, you know, whether or not you were isolationist or interventionist, and, you know, I mean, it carried over into foreign policy, and whether or not, you know, It was a world conspiracy, and it just, you know, some of the same things. I mean, certainly some of the same elements are continuing today.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that and what you see is kind of the residue of all of this that we see today. Not only the same kinds of things happening again because the fear is out there and the economic conditions are similar and it provides that fertile ground for demagogues, but talk about what you see as the specific residue from these incidents as they have sort of played through with on the American psyche over the past 80 years.
Well, I think that, I really think that 33 really kind of set the stage for this. I mean, there had been, you know, brutally vicious political campaigns, presidential campaigns in the past, in the 19th century, and the, you know, with Jackson campaign and stuff. But this was really kind of the start where it was fair game to this kind of ad hominem attack based on nothing. I mean, rumor, xenophobia, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-immigrant, anti-other. I mean, this is really kind of the beginning of this real coalesced demonization, and which is now kind of become pro forma. I mean, it's just accepted anymore. Like, this is just what America is. And I really see this you know, early 30s as the start of that. And I really, you know, I kind of got into this from a backhanded way after doing the research on the 1950 campaign in California by Richard Nixon against Helen Gehagen Douglas. And I was thinking that's really the start of the right wing in America in 1950, and looking at all that and the, you know, the Birchers and... But then as I went back into the 30s, I saw all of this, you know, the American Liberty League, and you had the silver shirts and the all these kind of paramilitary extremist organizations throughout the country, you know, Christian and
right.
and non-Christian. I mean, all of it. It was really, you know, it's a strong American tradition at this point.
Right. It's interesting to see the inflection points, and that's maybe another story, how this kind of hostility and hatred and vitriol and all of the things that were going on in the 30s, how after World War II, all of that energy kind of morphed into the Cold War, and that in turn, you know, creates this atmosphere that you talk about with respect to California and Nixon and Helen Gehagen Douglas, that then leads later on to what we see today.
Right, and to the Cold, I mean, that could be a whole other book, too, but the
right.
whole Cold War and then the whole, the anti-immigration thing going on today, again, and it, you know, it stuns me, someone like Mitt Romney, whose family, you know, whose father was born in Mexico, you know, taking this strong anti-immigration stance, and it's a fascinating line of inquiry.
It is interesting, one, the aspect that everything old is new again, but also the point that you made earlier is perhaps maybe the most important one, that if we can survive some of these things that we see that we've gotten through, maybe there is some hope for getting out of some of the current dilemmas.
I think so. I mean, you know, I write all these books about these sordid tales, but I'm always looking for these, you know, the lines of redemption here. And in the end, I think that this book, The Plots Against the President, was really, I think it is redemptive. And that, you know, America is really, it's stronger and more, while it's vulnerable, it's also very, it's got a lot of strength and ability to overcome all of these issues, I think.
Sally Denton, the book is The Plots Against the President, FDR, A Nation in Crisis and the Rise of the American Right. It's just out from Bloomsbury. Sally, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.